From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan, announcing show number 114, recorded live Monday, May 19th, 2008. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks website scaling with Richard Campbell.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm sitting here at DevTeach Toronto with my good friend Richard Campbell.
How are you, sir?
The legendary Richard Campbell.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I think you're a little more legendary than me. Last time I looked, you were keynoting, not me.
Oh, well, keynoting is funny because it's the earliest talk of the day. It's the shortest talk of the day.
Yes, I think that's what most people look for in a keynote, brevity.
Short and early so I can sleep through it. And that's exactly what I gave the people. So we were talking about ASP.NET scalability earlier, and I said, well, gosh, Richard, that's all we did at my last company was make big stuff and then see if we could make it bigger. And I know that's what you're working on right now. So let's talk about making big applications.
Well, and I think we take it from a slightly different angle because we're busy trying to find ways to put that scalability into an appliance.
Which is really interesting. When you first told me about the stuff that you were working on, I was like, oh, okay, this is a module I install, right? This is an HTTP module.
Right.
No, this is a rack. It's a pizza box that you put into the rack.
And you stick in front. Well, and it's the location became a key part of the whole equation, that made a big difference the way things go. But this is not what scalability is all about either. I think scalability really comes down to thinking through the problem. I think it's a very different way to think about your software when you talk about how is this going to behave with 10,000 people on it at once.
Right, right. I think that for a lot of people, you know, one web server and a nice beefy SQL server is enough.
I'm amazed at how many quite big sites I've found where that's exactly the scenario, where that's all it's on the machine.
Yeah.
There's a pair of machines and they're doing the job.
Well, and there's scale and then there's robustness, there's failover.
Yeah, reliability.
Reliability. I'm consistently surprised at how many sites don't have geographic failover.
Right.
Because I was working on banking software, there was here's the data center, and then there's the data center 150 miles away in case this one gets nuked.
Yeah, the whole disaster recovery model of how do we swap over in a hurricane.
Yep, and we actually had that. We had a bank in Louisiana, and we
right.
had to get down there.
For Katrina. I did a lot of work with companies like that through the Caribbean, and that was our normal pattern of behavior was to always have, typically it was Bermuda and somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
because only one or the other would be hit with a hurricane at any given time.
That's such calculated...
It was an interesting thing, and for whatever reason, a lot of the math of hurricanes is still in my head to this day.
Really?
Because for 8 months out of the year, that's what we thought about.
I can
what
see
was
you
happen.
Watching the CNN storm watch, and you're going, "Oh, that poor guy in his data center." I can just see that.
Actually, I always watched the NOAA website because they were the ones with the best predictions, and their software has gotten better and better every year. But there's only so many hurricanes, and you saw them coming from a fair ways away, and you knew, you know, roughly what it was. And there was just a fairly standard conversation that went on about at which point do we switch sites? And we do it well in advance and typically do stuff like fly all the hard drives out.
Really? You do that ahead of time?
Oh, absolutely. The data center would be down well before the hurricane got there.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's get back to basics. So when scaling an ASP.NET website, most people, in my experience, we'll take their one machine and their one SQL server, and then they'll just start adding
stuff.
More web servers, just adding stuff.
I think folks believe that they start out with, well, as soon as we have performance problems, we'll just add a web server.
Exactly.
And it's always in the context of a performance problem.
Mm-hmm.
Site's too slow.
Yeah.
I never hear anybody come to me and say, I think I'm having scaling issues. It's always site's too slow. I want to add another web server.
So that's interesting. So what is the difference between a performance problem and a scale problem?
Well, and I think most people see scaling problems manifest as perceived performance problems.
Mm-hmm,
that
exactly.
During rush hour, you know, whenever the site is busy, the site's too slow.
Right.
And that's the difference between a real performance problem where one person using it is too slow
mm-hmm.
versus, you know, thousands of people using it. So that certain times of the day, it's too slow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how they see the thing. But there's this belief that if I got another web server, everything would be fine. And I think that illusion exists really for the one server people.
Right.
Anybody who's actually gone through this process quickly finds out, yeah, it's not quite that easy.
Yeah. I've actually been doing scale for a lot longer than most people, because I got put into it in the 90s during the bubble.
Right.
When we didn't expect that we would ever have to deal with it. It was kind of a trial by fire. And I was working at a company called 800.com. And 800.com got purchased by Overstock.com.
Oh, yes.
They're all kind of part of that thing. I think that's how it was. I'm not sure. All the .coms chewed each other up. I'll probably get an email from someone who worked in that.
Yeah, saying you did it all wrong.
That's not how it worked out. But I was part of the four or five guys that worked on 800.com's website. And DVDs had just come out. And we said, let's have a promotion. 3 DVDs for $1.
Oh, wow. Back in like 1999?
Yeah, so it was all classic ASP, Commerce Server, Netscape 4.
Oh, man.
And I was in there optimizing tables for perception of speed and stuff like that. But what was really interesting about this problem is that, what is the typical behavior of a person on your site? That's one of the questions you should be asking yourself.
That just sort of, how do people go through your site? What do they hit? Mm-hmm. Where are they waiting? What do they look at?
Right.
You know, what are the touch points?
So simply spoken, in this instance, a typical experience on 800.com was about 95% browsing,
right,
which are read-only type things, and then 5% getting through the purchase process.
Right.
So then the argument is, well, which one of those is more important? Well, they're arguably both equally important.
Yeah.
But the perspective that we had was, once they really want to give us their credit card, it would be our job to do whatever we can
to keep that snappy.
Exactly. And not screw that up.
Right.
So now, change the scenario to 3 DVDs for $1. What happens? Well, browsing happens, and then suddenly the entire experience on the site flips, and 5% of the people are looking, and everyone else just wants to give us $1.
Trying to buy. Yeah.
So the entire scalability model for the site completely changed, and we started freaking out.
And in hindsight, completely self-evident that this should
have
happened.
Makes complete sense.
Yeah.
But at the time, when it's like 3 a.m. and it's like, okay, it'll be, in 2 hours, it'll be 8 o'clock in New York, and they're going to start again.
Yeah.
Because this was one of those things where it was spreading all over the net for about a 2 or 3 week period.
Yeah.
People were like, oh my God.
Three DVDs for an hour.
Ah.
Yeah, for an hour.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And they were coming up with ways to like cheat us.
Right.
Multiple shippings to one address and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, trying to find ways to get deals. Now, were you doing the specialization thing where all of your purchasing was on a separate set of servers that were running under HTTPS?
And that would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would make sense. And it's immediately when you're talking about this, I'm thinking, this is one of those typical things is we specialize so that we can scale independently. So mm-hmm. if you said, hey, I want the purchase process to be really fast, it's great. I'll create some HTTPS servers. Mm-hmm. That's all they'll do. And they'll be really snappy because they're not as busy.
Exactly. So that's the first thing that we did. Everything originally had been under www.800.com.
Right.
And then we broke it out. We broke it out actually into 3 different kinds of servers. We had our main browsing servers. That's the 95% of people who are reading stuff.
Right.
And that was not HTTPS. And we took those pages that showed the free DVDs and made them static.
Good.
Now, that sounds cheesy.
Oh, no, but brilliant. Really smart to do.
Rather than even bothering to cache them.
Yeah.
When the site would go down, it would have trouble getting back up, because one of the things that people don't realize when a site's being pounded on is that you hit somebody and they fall. And under scale, though, under load, you expect that guy to not only be able to get back up again, but to be able to get back up while still being beaten.
Yes. And still, recover somehow,
and
be back to normal.
So it is so much more difficult to get up once you have stumbled just once.
Yeah. And so, I do find that IIS goes into a tailspin.
Oh, yeah. IIS has always done that. And a lot of application servers where there's a process of startup. But nothing can start up and start serving pages faster than just a website dedicated to serving static files.
Sure.
So we basically code-genned a couple of times a day as stock changed these DVD pages, just those pages.
Right.
Did some redirects. So we had those pages will be static for a little bit. We had a server farm that was just the shopping cart and the checkout process.
Right.
And then because it was such an intense product image intensive site, we took images.800.com, moved all of the graphics away.
Right.
So we had a whole farm that was dedicated to that. So this was our kind of poor man's content distribution network.
Sure, but it's classic tactics of specialization.
Yeah.
Because I find IIS is dramatically a different product when there's no ASP.NET running on it. You can do things differently. It manages memory differently. There's a lot of stuff that changes. If you can get IIS set up, you're just serving images. That's all you're doing.
That's one of the things that I think is really cool about Server Core, is that you can make this tiny, tiny, tiny little Windows box. Doesn't even have a GUI.
Nothing.
Doesn't have, has like six modules installed, like, a rewrite module and a static image handler and a cache, and like, that's it.
Yeah.
And install none of the other stuff.
Yeah, I think Windows 2008 has made it much clearer that IIS can be different.
Yeah.
It's always been that way, but I think people don't really understand how dramatically different you can make IIS when you turn off stuff and strip it down to what you really, really need and nothing more.
Well, and this is slightly off topic, but the thing, in my opinion, that holding Microsoft back on that in that respect is that it's still confusing to me on how I can buy that.
Yeah.
I just want to buy it and use it.
And at the same time, they've done, Windows 2008, they've made it pretty simple to buy. There's the core and core all the different editions, they all sort of come together. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think people really get what that is. I think there's an OEM opportunity there. Folks selling, they stripped down core version IIS web server.
I'd love to be able to just have a regular Joe be able to go and get an ISO and burn it to disk and have a Server Core box running immediately.
Yes.
As a little app server. So that was one of my war stories, and that was, 10-11 years ago.
Well, you like I said, we were talking pre.NET.
But within .NET, though, you've got view state, you've got session. One of the first things that happens when you decide to scale out rather than scaling up and buying more hardware is you start thinking about, where is my session state managed, where is my cache managed?
Sure. And I think also that getting session out of the .NET memory context. As soon as you're under any kind of load, and I don't know if you've done a lot of research in this area, but one of the things that I've come to realize is most of these web servers running around there, which are 32-bit, mm-hmm. they got 4 gigs of RAM in them.
Yeah.
When you actually do the math and figure out how much memory you've got available to .NET in a clean configured machine, multi-core, 4 gigs of RAM, 32-bit, it only comes out to about 800 megs of space I can use in .NET.
Per process?
Per process, so typically per app.
What's the overhead? I don't know if this is true or not. I'm just saying these are the results I've ended up getting.
How much, when I'm looking at perfmon, I'm looking at how much can I allocate out before it starts GCing and going berserk. It's around 800 megabytes. And I think the OS is eating up a whole bunch that, your overall DLL loads and so forth. Like, there's just a bunch of stuff consumed.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Not per process really, but yeah. Okay. 800 megs if you had nothing else going on.
That is the stack. And so when you throw session into that space and caching into that space.
Yeah.
And then you put this thing under some load, you run out of memory in a hurry.
Yeah, it's funny. When someone tries to start aggressively caching, whether that be output cache or formally caching, there's, from a business perspective, there's Cartesian product that happens.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I had an issue on DOSBlog a couple of years ago where I had a giant archives file. If you go to my blog and you click on archives, it's about a half meg. But DOSBlog has this feature where we'll localize the things that we can for the visitor. So I'll show dates in German for German viewers.
Right.
And what was happening was someone would say, hey, your archives page is in German suddenly. Well, what had happened is that a German showed up first.
Right.
I cached the page. So then I go and say, oh, well, shoot, I need to cache a different copy of the page for each person that hits the site.
Right.
Well, you have sufficient traffic, you have sufficient languages, then you think about the 26 or some odd number that .NET supports of arbitrary languages that they can show the date for.
Right.
26 different people from all over the world decide to hit the site, each one getting their own cached version of the site. Next thing you know, you've just blown 13 to 20 megs.
Just on those cache items.
For one page.
Yeah, just one page. So, talk about a war story. Just this is actually early this year, I was dealing with, and I don't do a lot of consulting anymore, but this was a favor. It was in an unusual place. I'm going to leave out the names to protect the guilty. And they had gotten the caching hammer. They had gone nuts and cached every page they could lay their hands on.
And that's a really common
mistake. I think we get into this over enthusiastic use of caching. And so the behavior on the site, and this was an application they installed at customer sites. Mm-hmm. So they'd done this huge caching rev, and for their biggest customers' behavior, they had about 1,000 users internal. For about a half an hour, from a clean start, the site would clunk.
Yeah.
And then the excuse, of course, was, it's still popular in the cache. Don't worry. The cache will get all popular.
It'll be really fast. Things are really good.
And about half an hour later, it would be fast for about 10 minutes. And then it would freeze for about a minute while the garbage collector ran through and threw everything out of memory, and then it would clunk for half an hour again. Right. All day long.
When you set up cache, when you set up session, people forget that it's not just as easy as putting something in cache. It's about the life cycle of that.
Yeah.
When's it going to go away? Why is it going to go away? When it goes away, how's it going to come back?
And how long is that going to take? What is the impact of that? So we actually had a great time instrumenting cache items. So how many times does this cache item get hit? How many times does this cache item get destroyed? How many times does it get repopulated in a given day? And just looking at the data we got from that and finding out this cache item is repopulated pretty much every time it gets used. Mm-hmm. You know, between the time that the first time it's requested and gets cached to the next time it's going to get requested again, it will be thrown out of cache.
Right.
Do not cache that.
Yeah.
But until we actually instrumented all this caching code, we didn't know.
Right.
And I could actually turn around. And I find good caching code confuses junior programmers.
Yeah.
That whole, does the cache item exist? Right. Test first. And then, all right, it doesn't exist. So now thread block. So only one person at a time can do this. And then check to see if the cache item exists again. So in case somebody else came in and is now sending thread block. Right. I mean, that's the code that junior devs fix over and over again for you. So every time I can eliminate that stuff is a good thing. It cuts down on the problems I've got with other people trying to understand it, or somebody adding a new page that relates to a cache item but forgetting to do expiry, and on and on and on. So I'm a big believer in, can we lynch as much cache and code as possible? Can we avoid it? And can we instrument it in such a way that we can actually see, is this truly providing benefit to us?
Yeah, from my point of view, I don't feel I should have to be writing that kind of code. I like the idea of being able to, you know, attribute something or mark something and have it handled, because this is a common pattern.
Yes.
And anytime something is a common pattern, I expect the best practice to be embodied within the library.
And I'm glad you think that way, because I'm making a product that does that.
Okay. Well, this is not a 30-minute ad for your product, though. But
you know, I totally agree with you that the other side of the caching equation there is this whole, I have domain expertise. I have a group of people who are being really good at building an app. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly one of the items on the feature list is performance.
Yeah.
And when it gets to the top of the list, you need it right now. Like, it's not like every other feature you haven't finished
people
yet.
People don't tend to build this stuff in. I mean, if you start thinking about performance early on, you always get accused of being a premature optimizer.
And wasting time and so forth. And there's merit to that. I mean, there is an angle on ASP.NET that its big strength is speed of development. Mm-hmm. And that if you don't ship these features, nobody's going to care about your app anyway. When I was making a living as a consultant doing exactly this stuff, you know, you always start the day off with, well, congratulations. You have a good problem. People care enough about your app that they're making it perform badly, and they're unhappy that it is. Mm-hmm. You know, the alternative is nobody cared.
That's a good point.
I mean, just start there. Recognize you have a good problem in play already, and then go into, now, you know, how are we going to resolve this? But it just, you know, by the time they actually get performance to the top of the feature list, they're in so much pain. And the fact that it's no guarantee you're going to get results if they don't know what they got to do, and it's a different set of skills, I just find it very disruptive to get into performance tuning.
So let's just take a very brief moment, and we'll thank our sponsors, because I got to pay the bills.
Yeah.
And we'll be right back. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman with a word from our sponsor. Do you know how to build Web 2.0 AJAX applications with Web 1.0 components? You really can't. If you want to do the next generation web applications, you'll need next generation components. Just like the ones that our friends at Telerik have got, they're RAD controls for ASP.NET AJAX. It's a huge pack of web controls built on top of ASP.NET AJAX that'll add previously impossible performance and interactivity to your next project. The new controls mirror the AJAX API from ASP.NET, so development is really straightforward. The client scripts are shared, so loading time is not a problem. You just set a couple of properties and you'll be able to automatically bind to web services for a really efficient operation. The new RAD editor from ASP.NET AJAX Telerik loads up to 4 times faster than before, and the new RAD grid handles thousands of records in just milliseconds. But as always, it's best to try for yourself. So you can visit telerik.com/ASP.NET AJAX and download a trial. Thanks a lot. So we're talking about performance and how you're saying junior programmers have trouble with this. What are we not teaching them in computer science class? I've never taken a performance tuning, debugging.
Have we ever seen a class on that?
How do you find, I mean, I'm sure there probably are, but I mean, in my years in university, we never had any, here's something broken. Find the bottleneck.
Well, and yeah, diagnostics all by itself. Oh, what God. Do I need to fix? Yeah,
speaking of worst, I was at a large bank that I can't say the name of that we spent 3 days. It was one of those things where, you know, on Tuesday it gets slow. On this day of the month, da-da-da-da-da. It was like, you know, basically when the people get their checks, they go and they deposit them and they immediately pay their bills. And right. That's the busy day. And something was slow, but it was a multi-tiered system. So you've got web servers talking to business servers, talking to intermediate queue servers, talking to mainframes.
Just trying to get through to where the problems lie.
And it's at the point we were at, it's a performance problem. We have not yet identified it as a scale problem.
Right.
And I'm a really, kind of Sherlock Holmes type in the sense of, well, while people can throw out highfalutin ideas about what they think might be wrong, I just say, all right, well, let's just start at the web server and let's look at queues. It's all about queues.
Right.
Who's waiting? How many threads are in line to get some actual work done? Because there's only so many processors on the machine and there's only so much work that can be going on. Is the web server working hard? Well, in this particular instance, the web server was chilling.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. People are waiting 20, 30, 40 seconds for the site to come up, and the web server is not doing any work. Okay, so what does that tell us?
Something. Obviously, somewhere else is the bottleneck.
Something somewhere else. If the web servers were saturated at 100%, at least I could do something about that.
Sure.
I could get...
Well, you know that this is where I got to go start looking for the problem.
Right. So they were 30%, 40%. So then I think to myself, well, what kind of NICs are in this web server? Is this a 100 megabit or gigabit? Is it saturated? There's been a number of times when I've worked on sites and they've had 100 megabit cards and they were saturated.
Yeah.
And no one ever thinks to check.
Yeah. And well, they never consider the fact that's a problem. I ran into a rack where somebody had thrown a 10 base T switch in the back of the rack to do some testing and left it between the web server and the outside connection.
Oh my God.
So of course the web server was never busy. The site performed appallingly.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we actually physically got there and said, what is this? Why is this here?
Yeah. Yeah.
That we actually, you know, you got to find those things.
You start walking these things back. You look and being able to know what to look at in Perfmon. And these aren't Windows specific. I mean, this kind of scale work is applicable in any operating system. But the theory behind that, the idea that, I mean, just that very, very basic assumption that you and I just made that, well, the CPU is not working. Therefore, we must be blocked waiting for a resource.
The problem must be somewhere else.
That simple statement.
Yeah.
Where do you get that? Did you just learn it in the School of Hard Knocks?
I think so. I totally agree that, I also think that the reflex to check that the cords are plugged in, that is my NIC saturated, is the machine on,
yeah.
is also because you'll get burned by it one of these days. That's the only time you really grab on to, you know, have we done these dumb things I don't think it's also, as we tend to, it's usually not our problem, right? We've been brought to the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I have this assumption that the guy that I'm working with is intelligent and has pursued his obvious skill set. So I'm going to look in the unobvious skills.
Yeah. The idea that the power might not be plugged in. Someone told me once that when you call tech support, they'll tell you to like pull the power cord out and plug it back in.
Right.
Sometimes what will happen is, the person, I'm not going to check the power cord. I mean, of course it's, well, just go ahead, just do it. Humor me. Check the power cord. Sometimes it won't be on. It'll be unplugged.
It will be unplugged.
But they won't say anything.
Yeah.
They'll just say, oh, I jiggled the power cord and
everything's fine.
Everything's fine now. Well, thanks for your time. But that gives them the opportunity. So session state can be a problem because people forget that session state lives, it has node affinity.
Yes. Well, and so we started on session a while ago, and I sort of jumped immediately on the memory consumption is a big deal.
Sure.
I've seen sites where we got session out of process, but not centralized. I didn't care about my node affinity. I cared about my memory consumption. And so, I mean, there's actually scenarios where you throw a state server on the web server and you're better off. Well, it's also
just giving it its own process.
Giving it its own process. So the worker process can recycle, but you still got your session data.
Yeah, you know, this is a really huge thing. I have taken in the last probably 5 years to always running state server in my development experience.
Yes.
I do not run in proc session state.
Well, it's just getting away from stupid serialization mistakes, right?
Right, because if you don't mark your object as serializable, they'll never make it over there.
Yeah.
But it's one less thing to worry about. And I've had situations where we were running live production sites within proc session, and we needed to go and switch over to state server.
Yeah.
But somebody didn't mark one object serializable, and then that...
And all of a sudden, things go berserk. And it's not like a sign pops out of the server saying something's not marked serializable.
Right.
You have to go and hunt these problems down. it's agonizing, really. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and I like the idea that you always ought to process, because as you develop, you'll catch those mistakes.
I would prefer that that was the default.
I tend to agree. I mean, people struggle over the performance loss you get going out of process. That it is a hit. There's no two ways about it. And the way I usually describe it when you're talking about scalability is, you know, good scaling site is not necessarily the fastest site. It's consistent. It doesn't matter whether there's one user, 10,000 users. I want the distance between performance of one user and 10,000 to be as narrow as possible. And I'll move both lines. I'll make one user slower to get it closer to the 10,000. And one of the ways is I'm going to go out of process.
You know, that's a really good expectation to have of your site. And I think few people have such what they would perceive as lofty expectations. But the idea that, well, the site's running a little slow. There's 1,000 people on there.
Right.
Why is it? It should run as if you're the only person on the site.
It should behave the same all the time. I think consistency in terms of customer comfort, whether that customer is your employee or your CEO or an external person, customer comfort is the more important thing here. Consistency matters.
I think that Google does a good job that I never think to myself, oh, well, Google's slow today because there's a lot of people on
right.
it. I've never ever thought
never
that
thought that for
Google.
A moment.
I've always felt like, especially with Gmail as an example, that I'm all alone.
Yeah.
On my own private little Google server, and I visualize this one little guy, my little private server in the sky. I know it's not the case. It's probably fragmented all over a dozen.
But I also think that a lot of people think they're always all alone on the internet. They rarely think about other people are there. And that's why they complain the site is slow. Right? They never consider the idea that maybe it's 1,000 people. You know, it's all those other people that are causing the problem. Hmm. Right? I don't think people think like that.
Yeah, I guess they probably don't.
Talk about managing expectation. Mm-hmm. You'll see that there are some sites out there that'll let you know how many people are on the site right now.
Oh, I love that.
And that's
I love
really
those forums
about,
where they
yeah.
say, there's 27 other people reading right
reading
now.
This right oh, now.
I should do that on my blog. That
absolutely
would be really
a
fun.
Great idea. I mean, and really what you're doing is saying, well, how many active sessions? What was the last page you looked at?
I guess session count in ASP.NET would be the best way to do that.
Active session count would be a way. I do think like last page viewed, if you were keeping track of that in sort of a global level so that you'd know what page they were on. Mm-hmm. But the feeling of people being aware that there's other people on the site, I think it also makes them more tolerant of the fact that there may be performance problems.
You know, that would be a really, really fun thing for a blog software to take a blog like DustBlog or Subtext and make it more social by saying there are this many people on the site and then click on that and have a list of the pages that they're currently looking at.
Right.
So that I can go look at those pages too.
Well,
I know this has been done before.
I'm sure it has. I'm sure we could find the software for it. I mean, great. Just put this on your list for DustBlog.
Oh,
on
yeah,
a sidebar, what pages are currently being viewed?
Oh, yeah. I got to do that tonight. That's a great idea. But that break. So here's an example. Now we'll get back to the whole point here. You and I always end up just chatting about randomness. We'll call this the Random Show with Richard Campbell. That would be an interesting problem to solve.
Yeah.
Because how would that fundamentally change the way the site works? I mean, DustBlog is an interesting application because we don't have a database.
Right.
A lot of people know this, but a lot of people don't. Everything in DustBlog is stored in XML. So what are some things that you might guess, Richard, are difficult for DustBlog to do that other websites might take completely for granted? If you have a little thing in the corner there, just a little badge, and you decided to have the badge or not have the badge, what kind of things could I put
there? I think
there?
The customization per user is going to be a problem.
Okay.
I think I'm curious. I don't know the answer to this. I mean, how are multiple people going to simultaneously add comments to things? You're going to have to keep them separate.
So we actually have to have we have one file per post. Actually, one file per day.
Right.
So there's a file that is the date, the current date .xml, and all of the posts for that day are in that.
Right.
XML file. And then there's a separate parallel file just for comments, but we basically put them in an in-memory queue and we have to go and get in line. So we have to serialize on that point.
You've
so that
written
we don't
your own version of SQL Server's Lazy Writer.
Yeah.
You have a transaction manager that's taking in all those things in the first
place,
and the Lazy Writer is spooling them to disk.
It is, and it's always immediate. It's very, very fast.
Oh, yeah.
But it is a point of serialization.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another really interesting thing when doing scale, and thinking about how expensive is it to read versus how expensive is it to write? The idea that I might have to get in line in order to write.
Right. Well, and I think these are classic scaling problems where this is never an issue until it is an issue, until enough people are using the site at the same time, and you get these random bugs, and they're relatively tough
to
reproduce.
DustBlog has actually, because more people are reading my blog in the last couple of years, DOSBlog has found a lot of really interesting bugs that you just don't find unless people hit your site simultaneously.
Right.
And that's been really interesting. So what we end up doing is people will put stuff up, and then I'll just say, all right, well, how are we going to load test this? Well, we're an open source project, and we're kind of not as organized as we could be, and we don't have any formal load
right.
testing. So we throw it up on my blog and see if my blog tips over.
Yes. If your blog can survive it, most of the customers of DOSBlog are going to survive as well.
Exactly. That's kind of the idea. So back to my original question. It turns out that if you put a blog stats widget, it just says how many posts, how many comments, and let's something harmless, most commented post.
Right.
Seems like a trivial thing. I'd like to have a badge in the corner that says most commented post. Just think about this from a business person's perspective.
Right.
You paid me to write DOSBlog. We'll say you're the business guy, and you say, hey, programmer Scott, I need you to put up most commented posts and then, you know, have a top 10 list. And I go, we store all of our posts in XML. I have to go through every single file. Just do it. It'll be fine.
It'll be fine. What could be the problem?
Well, so 6 years later and 1,800 XML files later,
right?
Suddenly I realize, programmer Scott realizes, that we have no database.
Right.
And that arbitrarily querying 1,800 files is difficult. So then what do you start doing? Well, you make a big index and you start caching stuff.
You're carrying an aggregate.
And basically chasing your tail. So at some point, DOSBlog will have to move to either something like Lucene, where we can cache all of this stuff and have an index of some kind. We have a very internal custom index that was built under pressure because things stopped scaling.
When you were having this problem, when performance creeped to the top of the feature list.
That's an example. I mean, a lot of people have blog stats on their blog, and we build it and we have to, and we cache it. The problem is the building requires looking at every single file on the hard drive, and it takes about 60 seconds on my machine, which then times out.
The query times out.
The query times out.
Yeah.
And if I do it in a background thread, not as kicked off as part of a page view, then that thread can take the whole machine down because it's just frantically opening all these files. And
the file handle pounding must be unbelievable.
Well, and it's not just 1,800 files, 6 years times 365 days a year, but it's 1,800 times two.
Right.
Because you've got posts in one file and comments in another.
Comments in the other file.
So then this really harmless idea of most commented posts, popular posts, blog stats, becomes almost impossible.
Yeah, and most painful part of the whole app.
Yeah, and then it makes me wish I had a database. But that's the kind of thing where if you didn't build up this a clean architecture that expected that ahead of time, which we didn't, a business guy asks what seems to be a fairly innocuous question.
That he's seen elsewhere.
Oh, yeah. Everyone else has this. Why don't we?
Why don't we?
And now that's a kind of unique to DOSBlog, but I think that people find themselves in those kinds of situations. Like at this banking software company that I worked at, it was very transactional based, and you'd go to the transfer money page and you transfer money. You'd go to the balances page and you look at your balances. And it was very one page, one transaction. And then the whole portal thing started happening at the early 2000s, and people wanted to have widgets that they could drag around like live.com, where you've got, you know, half a dozen gadgets in the weather and da 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 da.
Sure.
And then this thing becomes 10 transactions per page to go and get information like mortgage rates and balances from other accounts and history. And
that sort of dashboardy composite of a view.
So suddenly this one page, one transaction model becomes one page, 12, 15 transactions. This is really common.
Mm-hmm.
DOSBlog, another perfect example. You give them a macro language and you let them start talking arbitrarily against your database, and then one page, one post turns into multiple posts.
And you get into deadlocking scenarios where two or three of these aggregate things run at once and they conflict with each other.
And you absolutely nailed it. Yeah. And that was the problem at this banking company, was that we got to go and get in line. So we may start out as 10 threads, but everybody has to merge onto the freeway.
Well, you get these conceptual singletons hidden away in the app, where when we reach into this, we must reach it in the same order, and we must wait and turn till we're all finished.
And they never feel like conceptual singletons at the time, but they inevitably end up like that.
Yeah. And I also think that the serialization description is a good way of describing that. Is we need to serialize this entire block of behavior. Mm-hmm. And so, you've got to look at it as a whole. And I tend towards the database view on these sorts of things as well, right? And there were definitely times in SQL Server where the right thing to do was to turn up the serialization level, make it more restrictive, because that forced people into order, and it actually turned out to be faster than fighting the contention of everybody trying to do it at the same
time.
Because
what do they say, that the optimal number of threads in any system is one?
Yes.
And it's funny how things like that are the case. Also, deferred execution is really important.
Yeah, well, not making stuff synchronous that didn't actually need to be synchronous.
Exactly. An example, and I keep coming back to DOSBlog because I come back to the projects that I worked on. Clemens Vasters realized very early on that writing to the log was important, but not as important as getting the page back to the user.
Right.
So he was very, very good at these fire and forget thread spin-ups, where he would just say, all right, we just had a referral show up, or we just had a track back, or whatever.
Right.
Handle that. And there is a possibility that it might not work. But you have to ask yourself, if this transaction fails, does that mean that the user should lose out?
Yeah. Do I need to let the user wait while I make sure that transaction completes?
Yeah.
Like, it's not actually critical to the deliverable. It is critical to the net result. I mean, it's two different things. And I think we don't tend to prioritize our work properly, where everything comes out at the same priority.
What are some of the kind of problems that you guys are bumping into? Because you're working for a company that makes a scale appliance, and you must be talking to customers. You got to tell me some kind of war story that you guys are seeing in the wild without telling me the names.
Oh.
What are the classic ASP.NET mistakes people are making when trying to scale?
Well, I mean, certainly I think they're finding that they're battling back and forth on overusing technology like caching or even folks that have gone mad and stripped every ounce of view state out of their page and then are frustrated with their rate of development. Like, there is that sort of, we're in this battle. Well,
that's really interesting. So you're saying that people are getting frustrated with view state because they don't necessarily have the metrics to prove that it's the problem.
Right.
They feel
this is so much gut behavior for performance tuning.
Really?
Right. Not using empirical data, saying we have a mandate to the maximum amount of view state in our page is 20K. I love that.
Totally arbitrary number.
Where did you get that number from?
Yeah.
You know, why 20? And this page is bad because it's got 22K of view state.
A lot of people don't even know what's in view state.
Why it's there, how much less how to dial it back. For the most part, most folks we've seen that are trying to reduce the view state, their only mechanism is turn view state off on that control. Mm-hmm. Now turn it off on this control. And
you know what I like to do is I turn it off completely and then turn it on.
And turn it on, which again I think that's the logical default. But it's not the way that it works. It should default that way.
Well, and I think that's a really tough thing because you just made the juxtaposition between performance versus speed of development.
Right.
Well, Microsoft, now that I'm starting to understand what they think about, they have to make that distinction between speed of development versus the expectation of the developer. They wanted ASP.NET to just be one of those things where you can drag a button onto a page and it works.
Right. It needs to just work.
Pit of success. I fall into the pit of success. Even if you screw it up, it just works.
It just works.
But if I had to go and then click the view state on that control to make that work.
Now it's an obstacle.
How many support calls is that?
And so much of Microsoft's behavior is focused on the first 10 times a customer uses a particular feature.
And not the last 1,000.
And not the last 1,000. I also think one of my favorite defaults, and I talk about this in sessions all the time, that people, A, don't know about, but B, when you really think about it, realize it's a good default, but seems totally nonsensical, ASP.NET's default worker process restart is 23 hours. That's the default setting for a cold install of IIS. Every 23 hours, restart the worker process.
Really?
That is
the default. I thought it was 20 minutes for IIS 6.
For restarting the worker process?
For restarting the app pool. Recycling the app pool in IIS 6, the default app pool, I thought it was 20 minutes.
No, 23 hours.
23 hours?
At which, again, it's one of those goofballs.
But there's a default. The point is,
it's
going to restart.
And somebody had to pick it.
Yeah.
And I bet they killed days arguing over what is the default.
Well, why does it need to restart at all, though?
Well, that is the point. It's why do we have this guaranteed default of restarting the app?
Well, I think what happened was that early on, ASP.NET was a mashup of COM objects that people wrote. And remember all the COM visible and how add COM reference was so important? And lots of people had those managed, unmanaged, unholy hybrids.
Bridges, yeah.
That everyone had the bridge project in 2003 that they had to make, and they would leak.
Yeah.
So you'd restart.
It was the only way to know you were going to get your memory back.
Yeah, I don't know about the idea of a fresh restart, but ultimately, if you can restart the worker process and not lose anybody,
right,
which calls back to the idea of having out of proc session state.
Well, and generally, everything that is stateful in a context where it's not going to get lost, right? I mean, really, we'd like to do that restart in a sort of seamless way where nothing was running at that moment. We queued up the threads, we restart the process, and then we unload the threads and everything keeps going. And it doesn't work that way, but it'd be nice if it did. I've got folks trying to use the appliance to do those sorts of tricks. They want to cache the whole site on the appliance and restart the web server. So the customers never see it.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, we used to do bleeding off of sites, right?
Right.
So if you've got 10, 15 web servers, and what you can do is do rolling updates.
Yes. Where you set the server to take no new sessions, and so gradually all the sessions expire off, and then that server is available to do the update on, and you get to a certain point where now you flop the other set of servers, and then bleed out the rest.
It's amazing to me. We were doing this kind of stuff in 97, 96, and I don't mean to be an elitist or anything, but I am continually surprised how many people would rather just go in on Sunday morning at 2 a.m.
and kick the fewest number of customers off,
right?
But still kick them off,
right? But somebody's having a lousy experience.
Yeah.
But bleeding, you get a really good, IP load balancer like an F5 or a local director. You can bleed sessions off really quite nicely.
Yep.
Well, then there's also that app offline thing that ASP.NET has, where there's that HTML file that you can put in the root that will keep it from accepting any new sessions.
Right.
But most people just
copy files over and let the users have a wacky experience for a few minutes and go from there. And I just, in part of the research we've done, searching around Strange Loop and so forth, finding out how many customers actually do have good instrumentation around session and say, yeah, we're running at about a 5% session loss, but we don't have enough complaints to bother to fix it.
5% session loss?
5%, they're saying, one in 20 users lose their session in the course of a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we actually, and just because we know that doesn't mean we're going to do something about it. We're actually measuring the number of calls we're getting as our metric of happiness.
I was working at this another large bank, and we were having a pretty crazy day, and we were basically working on the engine of the car while it was going downhill 100 miles an hour on fire.
With a brick wall at the bottom of the hill.
Being chased by ninjas who were also on fire. So we're trying to work on this thing, and we look at the perfmon, and we're trying to figure out how many people are having a bad experience. It was like 5 or 6% errors. So like 5 or 6% of pages were resulting in a 500 error.
Right, an internal server error.
And they were saying, well, no one's calling.
Yeah, that's the real metric.
Like, wait a second, 5% of people are having not just a weird experience, but a wholly and completely bad experience.
Yeah, complete failure.
Complete and utter failure. Why is that acceptable?
Yeah.
I mean, what happens if you walk into a bank and talk to a teller and he's like, oh, I'll be happy to and he falls over. And you're like,
I was just thinking doesn't open for 1 in 20 people.
No, I'm
but
talking
okay.
about I got halfway there and the teller just started talking nonsense and fell over.
The teller walks away. Right? Mid-transaction, the teller walks away, doesn't come back.
I think I like my
example. You like yours better. The weird language.
But yeah, something horrible happened. I mean, you've had that happen. I had a really bad experience in Detroit. I was at this restaurant, and I walked away. I was the one that was just I looked at the waitress, and I was just like, I don't know what happened there. Obviously, we've gotten off on the wrong foot. And there's no way that I can recover from this transaction.
Yes.
So I'm going to roll back.
I'm just rolling back and going somewhere else.
I just walked away to another restaurant. And does that mean I'm ever going to visit this restaurant again? Probably not.
Well, and of course, now you get into the whole customer game of, you tell somebody, although you're crazy this way because of your bloody blog, that you only tell a few people, when you do something right. We tell a lot of people when something wrong goes on. Like, just think about how many bad experiences people have online. Mm-hmm. But I also wonder if that's an accepted part of the practice too.
You know, and it's getting worse. I put a Macintosh in my kitchen, and I made it a kiosk for the wife, and she's mad at me because a bunch of sites actually not just don't work well on Safari, but they'll sniff that you're on a Mac. And they'll say, oh, well, this site only, you know, the library in our city only works in IE6.
Period. That's an acceptable decision. Yeah.
So rather than excluding one browser for being funny, we will pick one browser.
Yes.
And all others are right. So then what does she do? She comes to me and she says, hey, this Mac sucks.
Yeah. Interesting. No. The website sucks.
Yeah, the website sucks. But yeah. No. I don't want a Mac anymore because I can't check out books at the library now.
It's so far removed from the actual problem. Like, what a great way to transfer the problem over. How many people believe that the internet has these significant unreliability problems simply because people are figuring not enough people complaining?
Well, actually, I have a very nice readership and who... whenever they see an exception on my blog, they'll give me a screenshot. So I'll get a yellow screen of death screenshot a couple of times a week. And I've got a particular macro that does one of the little ads that pays for the bandwidth on the blog that shows up on the corner. Every once in a while, it throws an exception. And without fail, my monitoring system is a kind individual from overseas who sends me this thing. And then I say, yeah, that happens sometimes.
Right.
I know I need to go back and fix the macro and remove that... call stack that shows up, but you hit refresh and it goes away.
Right.
So, who has the? Well, so already I've become.
You've become part of it. Well, and I've certainly become part
of the problem.
I've been the tech support guy where we measured the significance of a problem and whether or not it would persist long enough that someone would actually complete a call.
Mm-hmm.
That if this fixed itself within 60 seconds and we didn't answer the phone by the fifth ring until the fifth ring, then we were okay, because by the time we actually got out, they answered the call, they'd already hit refresh and it had gone away.
Well, Richard, this show didn't go exactly as I thought it would.
Never does with you and I, I'm afraid.
I'm afraid not. We'll have to try this again, because I don't know if I can call this scalability with Richard Campbell. I think I'm going to call it war stories. War stories with Richard. Well, Richard Campbell, thank you very much for taking the time to sit down with me here at DevTeach, and your product is... What's the name of your product? I know the company is Strange Loops.
The company is Strange Loop Networks, strangeloopnetworks.com. Yeah. And the product is called the AS1000 for Application Scaler.
Application Scaler 1000. Strange Loop.
And we now have a web services scaler, too, called the WS1000.
Very great. And I suppose that if a WS2000 comes out, it's going to be that much better.
It's that much bigger. And interestingly enough, you're right, we may have one soon, because we've got people who are using it so much, they want in excess of 64 gigs of RAM in it.
Wow. I should be a marketer. I just gave you the name of the next
Well, you just walked into my naming strategy perfectly.
Fantastic. Well, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.